today on Against the Grain, how do the ideas of Pierre Bourdieu compare with Marx's? What did the French thinker's critiques of Marxism reveal, both about the value of Marx's framework and the plausibility and coherence of Bourdieu's theories? I'm CS. We'll re-present a conversation with UC Berkeley sociologist Michael Bourvoy about his book Symbolic Violence, Conversations with Bourdieu, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What happens when a Marxist scholar engages with the ideas and theories of Pierre Bourdieu? Bourdieu, the French sociologist and public intellectual, was no Marxist, but his ideas influenced and still influence scholars and activists interested in how power operates and in whether those who are dominated and marginalized can turn the tables on those who dominate and oppress. Michael Bourvoy, a UC Berkeley-based sociologist and self-described Marxist, decided to put Bourdieu in conversation with Marx and with a number of prominent Marxist thinkers. The result is a fascinating book, just out, called Symbolic Violence, Conversations with Bourdieu. When Michael Bourvoy joined me recently in studio, he began with some biographical information about Pierre Bourdieu.
Pierre Bourdieu was actually born in 1930 and died in 2002. He's the most influential sociologist of our era, and remains so. One of my colleagues refers to him as the Mike Tyson of sociology. And in some ways, it's quite an apt analogy, since he does have sometimes a pugilist approach to other sociologists. So he's become incredibly influential, A, and B, it should be known to our listeners that he wrote about an enormous range of things. He wrote about journalism, he wrote about sport, he wrote about literature, the origin of what he called the literary field in 19th century. He wrote about impressionist painting, he wrote a lot about education, and he wrote a lot about politics, and he's often associated with the sociology of culture. So virtually nothing was beyond his intellectual grasp. And so what is interesting, he does have an overarching theoretical framework through which he actually examines these very different fields.
And what is the project of this book? What are you trying to do with and possibly for Bourdieu's thought?
Well, I think any self-respecting sociologist today has to grapple with Pierre Bourdieu. And I grappled with him in a particular way. Sociology has had a long sort of antagonistic and interdependent relationship with Marxism. And Bourdieu himself was influenced by Marxism in the 1960s when he was in France and with colleagues, many of them who were Marxists. So he grappled with Marxism in his early years. He also, I must add, spent a lot of time in Algeria. He was there from 1955 to 1960, where he also engaged with Marxism of the national liberation struggle. Anyway, he became more and more critical of Marxism, like so many, over the years. And he didn't take Marxism seriously. He had a critique of Marx, but he didn't actually acknowledge that Marxists themselves have made the same criticisms of Marx, and there's a whole Marxist tradition that he, I think, deliberately ignored.
Right. These are the what might be called the cultural Marxists, the thinkers who tried to introduce an analysis of culture that Marx had left out.
That's exactly right. So figures that people may know about are people like Antonio Gramsci. Well, the ones that I deal with in the book are Antonio Gramsci, Paulo Freire, and I deal with Simone de Beauvoir, who was a Marxist feminist. I deal with Frantz Fanon, who was a black Marxist from Africa. Well, that's where he wrote many of his works. He was originally from the West Indies. So these are the sorts of figures that I think Bourdieu really doesn't grapple with, yet they often say things that are quite similar to him. And so it provides the basis for a very, in my view, a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, let's talk about the conversation you put Bourdieu into with Marx and vice versa in one chapter of your new book, Symbolic Violence. And it's called The Poverty of Philosophy, Marx Meets Bourdieu. You begin this chapter, and it's reflected in the title of this chapter, by comparing how Marx and Bourdieu view philosophy as it was being done at the time that they wrote, that they respectively wrote. Why do you start this way?
Well, if two people are going to have a conversation, they need to start out at least with some sort of common ground. And what is interesting about Marx and Bourdieu is that they were both indeed very critical of philosophers as somehow removed and detached from the world. But not only that, that they believed that ideas drove history. And both Bourdieu and Marx are critical of this perspective. They think that material factors actually are as important, and for Marx, much more important than ideas. For Marx, it was the German idealists in the middle of the 19th century who thought that they were sort of making history by having arguments with one another. And he makes fun of them in the German ideology. In the same way, Bourdieu makes fun of his fellow philosophers in Paris who think they're also making history, but they're just playing with words. They're not really impacting history at all. So that's their common point of departure, Marx and Bourdieu.
Now, Marx owes a fair amount to Hegel. And Hegel, would you agree, is a kind of an idealist? What didn't Marx like about what Hegel was trying to say with kind of the evolution of an idea?
Right. Well, Hegel has the idea that ideas, or the unfolding of human consciousness, the development of human spirit, whatever that is really the essence of history. And Hegel had developed a school of philosophers that were critical of him, saying that basically it's this human spirit, this ethereal spirit, there's no there. We have to bring Hegel down to earth. And the most famous of these people was a fellow called Feuerbach. But Feuerbach too was an idealist. He had different ideas. He had the idea of species being, that human beings have this rich potentiality to develop their rich and varied abilities.
And can you talk a little bit about the materialist focus and emphasis of Marx? What, instead of ideas, was he saying drove history and would drive history?
Well, this is all subject to debate, but my view, there are basically four elements in this particular engagement with Bourdieu. I reduce Marx to four elements. One, a theory of history, which was a succession of modes of production. Now, a mode of production is nothing other than the way we produce things. And Marx viewed the way we produce things involved two sets of relations. One set of relations is our relationship to nature that we are transforming in some sort of labor process. And the other is the relationships of ownership. So it's not just who does what, but actually who gets what. Those are the sort of two dimensions of a mode of production. And then he said that, you start with a sort of sometimes called primitive communism, tribal mode of production, and then you move to the Asiatic, then you move to the feudal, then you move to the capitalist, and then Bob's your uncle, you move into communism. It's a sort of an evolution that people sort of are very skeptical of, and rightly so, I agree. But anyway, that was his view of history as a succession of modes of production. He also had a theory of the internal dynamics of each mode of production. He didn't have a theory of any mode of production except for the capitalist one. And he argued in the case of capitalism that as capitalism developed, as capitalists competed with one another, they generated, on the one hand, crises of overproduction, and on the other hand, they deepened class struggle. And he argued that there is a coincidence of the deepening of the crises of overproduction, which we see all around us today, coincidence of that with the intensification of class struggle that will lead to the working class seizing state power and introducing communism.
overproduction being capitalists overproducing things.
Right. And they come about because what is really happening under capitalism, they're competing with one another. And in the process of competing with one another, they drive down wages. And at the same time, they're producing more and more things. So there are fewer and fewer people to actually consume the greater amount that is being produced. And we see this. Capitalism goes through these cycles all along. But the point that I really want to make is that Marx had a theory of the dynamics of the capitalist mode of production and why it would sow the seeds of its own destruction.
Okay, so you gave us two elements of Marx's materialism. First, history as a succession of modes of production like feudalism and capitalism. Second, each mode of production has an internal dynamics. What are the other two then?
The other two, well, Marx also said that, and this is very important for the discussion with Bourdieu, he had a notion of superstructures. It was not just the economy, but there were superstructures that involved the production of ideology, education, philosophy, cultural forms, and politics too. Superstructures that actually, for the most part, kept the mode of production going. So ideology, for example, in this country, the ideology that if you work hard enough, you make it. That is a sort of a process. That is an ideology that actually many people believe, even if they don't, they know it's not true. They will still believe it. And it has the effect of atomizing the working class, making it more difficult to organize as a class. But anyway, the point is ideology is is important, even though he's critical of it amongst these German idealists. He never then brings it back to understand how actually capitalism manages to maintain itself, reproduce itself. That's the third. And the fourth is that history is also the history of class struggle. And that he believes, as I said earlier, in the intensification of class struggle. And this is what's so sort of interesting, because there's a tension between, on the one hand, the project of the state, of ideology, of culture, of politics, to maintain capitalism, to undermine the working class. And on the other hand, there's a tendency for the class struggle to intensify. And which of these two wins out will determine, of course, the fate of capitalism. And he was just optimistic, or too optimistic, that class struggle would actually dissolve the distortions that ideology brings, would actually counteract the intervention of the state to actually promote an increasingly militant and capacious working class. And we now know he was wrong.
Michael Borevoy joins me in studio. He's a sociology professor at the University of California, Berkeley. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Did Marx see class struggle leading to workers' revolution, leading to the overthrow of capitalism as inevitable?
Yes, I suppose he did, but he gave us the intellectual ammunition to understand why he'd be wrong.
How so?
Because, for example, what I was talking about before, well, the state, let's still talk about the state. He had, in my view, an undeveloped theory of the state. So what does the state do that he didn't anticipate? Well, the state basically has an interest in keeping capitalism going, and it has an interest in actually doing what Marx, in the end, really didn't think it could do, namely enforce concessions to the working class. So what do we get after Marx dies? We get sort of minimum wage legislation. We get some sort of control of the conditions of the workplace. We get the development of some sort of minimalist, in this country, welfare state, in other countries, much more developed welfare state, all of which are material concessions for the working class. So the working class recognizes that it actually can make gains within capitalism. It doesn't have to go beyond capitalism. So Marx didn't appreciate that there was a new form of capitalism after competitive capitalism that would be a state-organized, in principle, state-organized capitalism that would actually lead the working class to struggle within capitalism rather than beyond capitalism.
So you said earlier that both Bourdieu and Marx, Karl Marx, saw philosophy as disposed to dismiss practical worldly activity. And you write in your book, Symbolic Violence, Conversations with Bourdieu, that Karl Marx and Bourdieu, they turned in different directions after they said this. I mean, they basically agreed on that point about philosophy, ignoring material conditions. So you write that Marx turned to a logic of practice, and I think we can, since we're going to try and focus more on Bourdieu, we can say that, you know, he turned to labor, right? He turned to labor and the working class and this idea of the class struggle. So that was his turn to practice. Now, you can elaborate on that if you'd like, but what I'm most interested in is what Bourdieu, what his turn to practice was, and how that was different than Marx's turn.
Very good. That's so what I was just earlier saying was basically Marx's theory of the transformation of capitalism and the transition to socialism that rested upon the development of class struggle. Now, Bourdieu thinks, no, that, yes, we can go to the idea of practice, but that practice does not lead to the intensification of class struggle, quite the opposite. And he argues, when he examines the dominated classes, the working classes and allied classes, he argues that they develop a habitus that is inimical to the development of class struggle. He argues that they cannot see the conditions of their own subjugation. Now, Marx assumes that ultimately the working class can see through it all and see that their real interests are beyond capitalism. And he is the optimist, as I said. So Bourdieu is very much the opposite, the pessimist, and basically argues that the words he uses, that the working class misrecognizes the conditions of their subjugation, though understand that they are a dominated, exploited class. And so this is the fascination, to my mind, of Bourdieu's work. It threads throughout this idea of symbolic violence or symbolic domination. That is a form of domination that is not understood as such. And so he argues that the working class does not understand the essence of their subjugation, just as men and women don't understand masculine domination, just as the education process mystifies or misrecognizes the character of class. So much of his work is about that. So he argues that so deep is this habitus of misrecognition that actually there is no hope for an alternative future in the development of class struggle. It's not going to happen.
Now, habitus, one of the famous concepts that Bourdieu has forwarded, what is it? Like, how do we explain what it is such that it makes people not able to recognize the conditions of their oppression?
That's the most controversial of his concepts, is the concept of habitus. He has the idea that social structures are, in a sense, internalized, and as such, they are taken for granted or not recognized at all. And that non-recognition or taken for grantedness is embedded and embodied in the habitus. And the habitus is more than just a mental thing. It is also a bodily matter, that we, in the very way in which we carry ourselves bodily, sort of affirm the world rather than critique the world. So he has an idea that there is primary socialization, then there is secondary socialization. So there's a layering of people's habitus, which can be seen like a person's character. So there are layers in the character, and it's very difficult to dislodge it. And so if a individual is brought up in a particular class, that individual will have a particular class habitus, and it will be very difficult to change. And they will accept the conditions of their subjugation as a result of that. And he argues that basically, you know, where Marx would recognize that the working class may suffer from mystification, may not understand things correctly, through struggle, everything, all the mistakes that they make will be dissolved. For Bourdieu, struggle's not going to dissolve this working class habitus that accepts the world as it is and that actually often doesn't recognize class. And in this country, you know, it's interesting how difficult it often is to explain things in terms of class. Race, yeah. Class, more difficult.
How about an interrelated concept of Bourdieu? Field. The notion of fields is important to his thought. What are fields?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are three concepts, habitus, field, and capital. They're the troika. A field. Well, field is like a field, you know, like a football field in which there are players who engage with one another according to rules that are collectively accepted. It has some sort of boundary. And the idea in the most general formulation in a field is that individuals will try and accumulate as much of the field-specific capital as they can in order to dominate the field. So what characterizes a field are relations of domination. So in an economic field, the idea is to accumulate as much capital as you can, economic capital. And in the academic field, and this was very important because he is a very interesting figure in that he compels us to think about our own lives as academics. We're not just studying others. So he talks about the academic field where we are trying to accumulate academic capital. And indeed, you know, we do that and compete with one another. And we have all sorts of measures of academic capital. So what medals you get, where you publish your articles. There is a field of competition. And he's sort of... And sociologists, too, like to misrecognize the world, or social science like to misrecognize the world. And he forces us to think more deeply about the world that we construct as a field.
Do working class people, as Karl Marx thought about it, do working class people participate in fields? Do they operate within the realm of fields?
Oh, CS. Oh, you're asking all the million-dollar questions here. Yeah. There are places where you might think that the working class is part of a field, but when you read the entire oeuvre of Bourdieu, you have to conclude that no, fields are really located in the dominant strata. The dominant classes participate in fields, but the working class doesn't. That is in part probably because he's interested largely in cultural fields, and that is the realm of, for him, members of the dominant class. He calls them the dominated fraction of the dominant class of intellectuals. So, yes, so I think the working class is not in a field, which is very interesting. So, you see, he gets the idea of a field, in my view, from Marx's analysis in the three volumes of Capital of the Capitalist Economy. And there you see, quite central to Marx's analysis, is the competition among capitalists trying to accumulate capital. And they do so quite successfully. And they play according to rules that actually are guaranteed by the state. Now, Bourdieu's analysis of the economy looks at those capitalists competing with one another, but ignores a central feature of Marx's analysis, namely that this competition among capitalists is competition to actually exploit workers. The workers don't appear in Bourdieu's account of fields, and the economic field in particular. So in a sense, the working class is somehow is in social space, but it's outside fields. And the concept of exploitation is hardly present at all in the writings of Bourdieu.
That's the voice of Michael Burevoy, Burevoy. He teaches sociology at UC Berkeley. His books include Manufacturing Consent, Changes in the Labor Process Under Monopoly Capitalism, and The Politics of Production, Factory Regimes Under Capitalism and Socialism. His new book is Symbolic Violence, Conversations with Bourdieu. It's published by Duke University Press, Bourdieu being Pierre Bourdieu, the immensely influential sociologist who, as Michael shares in the introduction or first chapter of this book, Michael began as kind of a Bourdieu skeptic, as I think he says, an anti-Bourdieu. And then he warms up to him, and he's written a whole book about Bourdieu's thought in relation to many other thinkers, including Marx. And we are focusing on Bourdieu in relation to Karl Marx this hour. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Okay, so if, because of the nature of habitus, people are not able to grasp the conditions of their subjugation, and that there cannot be kind of a demystification of their situation as with Marx, then what's possible in terms of social change if people can't get out of this misrecognition that they are attuned to, I think unconsciously, right? Because isn't habitus embedded in the unconscious?
Yeah, good question against this. Yeah, that's really perhaps crucial. I don't think Bourdieu answers it. But my answer, my interpretation of Bourdieu would be as follows, that yes, the working class is not going to be a progressive force, and so we have to return to intellectuals. And I think the project of Bourdieu, though he never announced it as such, is what Conrad and Salani talked about in connection with Eastern Europe, which is not relevant to this conversation, the idea of intellectuals on the road to class power. I think ultimately, I think Bourdieu's saying that not all intellectuals, but some intellectuals, but particularly sociologists, and particularly him, are able to sort of recognize how the world works, recognize domination, and actually become major players in the direction of history. What that direction is not at all, in my view, clear. But I think underneath it all, there is some claim, a very paradoxical claim, given what we have already said, that actually people can be led to understand the conditions of their subjugation, can possibly be able to understand the world like sociologists.
And is this way, because it just would be the only logical way to me, is that sociologists, intellectuals actually share their insights with the working classes and thereby working folks gain this consciousness?
Very good. Yes, absolutely on the mark. Yes, so I think if you look at his theoretical works, his last major theoretical works called Pascalian Meditations, and in that book, he basically says, no, the dominated classes cannot see through their habitus. They cannot be a progressive force in history. But if you look at some of his other books, and I always use a book of interviews he did with his colleagues, La Misère du Monde, which is translated into English as The Weight of the World. In that book, what is interesting, each interview is quite a long interview. It's an extract from a longer interview, still itself long, and this has an introduction by a sociologist, one of his team members. It's a sociologist who has some sort of class connections with the interviewee, and the introduction never really sort of, except in one or two cases, contradicts the understanding of the interviewee. And so it seems to me the case, if you read that book, you get the impression that under the influence of these Bourdieusians, the working class and some of the middle classes, who are the respondents in the book, you know, they're farmers, they're blue-collar workers, they are teachers, they're social workers. That these dominated groups, not all of the working class, but these dominated groups actually do have a grasp of how the world works when they engage with one of these so-called Bourdieusians. And so the Bourdieusians can, through a dialogue with their respondents, actually come to bring them to understand. Perhaps they don't understand that they're understanding it, but when you read it, they understand the world through a Bourdieusian lens. In terms of another Marxist vocabulary, these people will be called organic intellectuals. However, Bourdieu's made fun of these organic intellectuals. He talks about the mythology of organic intellectuals time and again. He has completely dismissive of that idea. I suppose when he becomes such an intellectual, it's okay. But anyway, there is a paradox here. But that's, you know, great theorists have great contradictions. And that's why Bourdieu is so fascinating, that, you know, on the one hand, he seems to have a theory that says that, you know, the dominated classes cannot understand the conditions of their subjugation. Indeed, very few people can, just a few sociologists. And on the one side, and on the other side, his actual political practice, and particularly in the 1990s, when he really gets very angry about the way that the socialists are actually pursuing neoliberal policies. He's out there in the streets. He's out there sort of commandeering the workers and lecturing to the workers. So that's to my mind, that's at odds with his theory. You know, why is he doing that if they can't understand the conditions of their subjugation? So it's a really fascinating tension. And he writes these amazing pamphlets. For the most part, Bourdieu is relatively unintelligible. It's really difficult to read. But then towards the end of his life, he begins writing these pamphlets, and they are very accessible. And clearly he believes that they're having an effect, otherwise he wouldn't write them. Well, perhaps it's just for him. I don't know. By implication, I think, you know, he thinks that they're having an effect. And they do have an effect. He was one of the first people to ever talk about precarity in the early 90s. Now everybody talks about precarity. But no, he was one of the first. And he was capturing the character of the new working classes in France. So yeah, it's a fascinating guy.
Michael Bourivoy, his new book is Symbolic Violence, Conversations with Bourdieu. We'll take a short break and speak more with Michael about symbolic violence, about Bourdieu's curious faith in the state, and we'll talk more also about how Marx differs from Bourdieu. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Michael Bourivoy joins me. He is professor of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. And we are talking about his new book out from Duke University Press. It's called Symbolic Violence, Conversations with Bourdieu, meaning Pierre Bourdieu, the sociologist. So Bourdieu criticized Marx on a number of fronts, but in part because Marx lacked a theory of symbolic violence. So let's flesh this out a little bit more. What did Bourdieu mean by symbolic violence?
Symbolic violence or symbolic domination is domination not understood as such. What he says is misrecognized. So I think the prototype of symbolic violence for Bourdieu is masculine domination. And he writes a book with that title. So what does he claim? He claims in the book Masculine Domination that masculine domination has been naturalized by a long historical process which, in a sense, dehistoricizes the realities, variations, challenges to masculine domination, so much so that we now automatically take it for granted, both men and women. Sometimes he talks about it as it being legitimated, but more importantly, it is not even recognized as a form of domination. That men and women see that they do different things, that they are designed as human beings to do different things. They are essentially different. And that means that they are complementary and that domination doesn't really play a role in their understanding of the relations between them. Now, feminists have sort of been quite successful in indicating that there is something called patriarchy and that there is something called masculine domination. And in the Me Too movement that has received a lot of publicity, you might say that now we are quite aware of the ways in which men actually exercise domination through mobilization of whatever power resources they may have. I think if one's going to cling to the idea, to hold on to the idea of masculine domination as misrecognized, one has to say that, yes, these are seen to be as exceptional cases, and that under day-to-day normality is one in which men and women do not see themselves in a relationship of domination. That the aggressiveness of men that we hear about is not of the essence of masculine domination, but somehow apart from the relations between men and women. That's how I think Bourdieu would have to argue his case. But he does say at the end of the book that new forms of sexuality, new forms of relation between gender and sexuality, gay, lesbian, he talks about gay, lesbian movements, may begin to actually effectively challenge the categories of male and female. But then, of course, he might also say that, do we now then have a new set of categories that then become a way of misrecognizing domination? And it's very interesting. He also has an emancipatory notion of gender relations around the notion of love. It just comes out of, nowhere in this book. And when we read this, we sort of joke about, well, he must be going through some sort of very special relationship at the time. But because he has no, I mean, so different from Marx and Marxists, there is no idea of a future emancipated world in Bourdieu's theoretical framework, except at these one moment. So anyway, that's gender. So, but he does recognize there are moments and there are parts where that domination becomes possibly clear. But he thinks that the class domination is deeper even than gender domination, the masculine domination. And that's quite interesting. In a book, he the most famous of his books, I suppose, particularly in the United States, is a book called Distinction, which is a very, very, very thick book. Detailed analysis of the way in which people's tastes in music, in food, sort of an expression of their class position, and in a sense also mystifies, misrecognizes their class.
Why doesn't Bourdieu use the language and the concept of exploitation as does Marx? I mean, doesn't he see that workers are being taken advantage of in the workplace?
Well, I mean, there is a very, very interesting and curious few pages in Pascalian Meditations where he talks about the double truth of labor and basically argues that, not basically, he does actually argue that workers are exploited and at the same time do not recognize that exploitation, which is a very Marxian idea. Because Marx himself said that the whole point about exploitation is it's mystified. We don't actually experience the surplus labor that is pumped out of us as wage laborers or as feudal serfs. And so it's this blip, this Marxian blip in Bourdieu when he starts talking about labor. Though I must say that he does talk about labor in his studies in Algeria, which are themselves quite paradoxical. But he generally, in my view, avoids the word exploitation, focuses on the concept of domination. And I think it's because he doesn't want to take over too much of the Marxist vocabulary. And I think that for him, the central concept is domination. So you can still talk about managers dominating workers. I've never seen him write on the concept of, except for those two pages, on the concept of exploitation. I mean, he doesn't really study workers a great deal. In Algeria, he does, but that's really before he developed his theoretical framework. Yeah, one of the most interesting of his studies, fascinating studies, very readable studies, is of the peasants in his home area called the Béarn, near the Pyrenees, and he goes back there and studies them. And there he also doesn't talk about the word exploitation, but he might well have done. But that's a study, that's a very interesting study of the decline of a peasant society and the consequences that has for men and women. The book is called The Bachelor's Ball, and it opens up with these young women and men or young men from the towns. They've come to the villages and they're dancing with these young women. And the dance floor is ringed by these bachelors, some young, some old, who cannot find anyone to marry them because their land is losing value. And this is a product, though it's unexplicated really in the book, is a product of the way in which France has been inserted into the European Union and the agricultural policies that have been pursued in France. But it's a fascinating book. And but there, you know, too, I mean, there he talks about the peasant body and the way that these bachelors carry their body, the sense of humiliation that is so viscerally present in the way that they walk and talk. Yes, and so they're sort of they are dominated, you know, by their subjugation. Whereas, for example, men who dominate women are dominated by their domination. Everybody is dominated.
That's Michael Borivoy, teaches sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is Symbolic Violence, Conversations with Bourdieu. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What about the way Bourdieu regards the state? Now, the state, at least in its rhetoric, often says that it is represents the public interests. It acts in the general interest. What did Bourdieu, I guess at least in one point of his writings, at one stage of his writings, what did he see that as representing in a kind of hopeful, optimistic way, one that might point toward progression toward a better society?
Yeah, very good, yeah. Yes, again, sort of, he does this in many places, but as I say, his final great magnum opus is Pascalian Meditations, and where he says, as he does in other places, that the state operates according to a sort of principle of representing the universal interest. And though he acknowledges that the state often becomes an instrument of the capitalist class, its logic, its inherent rationality, is one that is leading to universalism. And what happens over time, and again, the intellectuals can play an important role in this, is to continually demand of the state that it lives up to its universality, to its principles. And of course, we see this around us, right? You know, we see the attempt, shall we say, by the Democrats to actually get the state to uphold the logic of the state, the logic of the Constitution. And the hope is that that will actually, in Bourdieusian vision, will actually lead to a progressive and greater progress in society. That's a very, from the Marxist point of view, that's a problematic claim, because Marxists do claim that, yes, the state has a certain autonomy, but that autonomy and that logic is actually a way of actually reproducing capitalism. The legal system for Bourdieu is one in which it is a codification of laws that can only be changed in a law-like manner. And he has an imagination, like another famous sociologist, Max Weber, that somehow the law will become more and more rational, more and more universal over time. Whereas Marxists are more likely to say, well, the law actually constitutes people as individuals, and the law actually appears to represent the universal, but has the effect of actually reproducing class. It's the very universality of not recognizing class as such that actually contributes to the reproduction of class in the economic arena. So there's a real clash there between the Marxist and the Bourdieusian perspective.
And given that, and given all the other ways, important ways in which Bourdieu differs from Marx, why would a Marxist like you bother to engage with Pierre Bourdieu?
Yeah. Well, I gave a series of lectures on Bourdieu in South Africa, and the audience was full of Marxists, and they couldn't understand why I was, you know, I had a critical view of Bourdieu, or why I was bothering in the first place to actually engage in this critique. And so I had to begin to think about why would a Marxist be interested in Bourdieu? Yeah. Well, the one answer is that he, in his pessimism, at least pessimism from the standpoint of Marxism, it's salutary. I mean, he's salutary. He's warning us. Look, this is a difficult project you Marxists have undertaken, and he's given us a framework within which to be self-critical. And when you read his theoretical writings, you really feel that this idea of working class engaging in struggle and transforming the world is pie in the sky. So I think we have to take that on. But we have to take it on not just as a process of self-education, but that's the reality of most people's thinking in the world. I mean, Bourdieu is a very sophisticated expression of progressive thought in the modern world. And it has great appeal to many people and has great appeal to sociologists, certainly more than Marxism does. So it seems important that one actually engages him in a dialogue, sort of underline the paradoxes and contradictions in his thinking, show that his pessimism is not always warranted, that his concept of habitus is a tautology and he has no evidence that people have a habitus that is so unchanging as he describes it, that he doesn't pursue tensions like the tension between the emergent habitus of the individual and the logic of the field. There is always that tension, which is the basis of social change. But he really doesn't examine social change, that there is a really deep problem in the entire work that is a theory of reproduction, that is a theory of the maintenance of the modern world of capitalism. It is not a theory of its transformation. And Marx and Marxists believe that as you reproduce capitalism, you also transform it. But there is no such real dynamic, in my view, in Bourdieu's writings. So I think by looking at him carefully, one is actually engaging with a worldview that is very powerful and resonates with many people, though even if they don't ever read Bourdieu. He expresses that view. And I think we can learn a lot by the problems of his theory. He is a great theorist, and as such, great theorists have, as I said, great contradictions. And pursuing them, we learn better how to actually develop a theory that will be simultaneously more optimistic, but also will resonate more broadly. We can't forget that Bourdieu was this incredible figure in France. I mean, you know, Mike Tyson or the Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, when Arnold Schwarzenegger dies, you can be sure it'll be on the front page. Well, I assume it'll be on the front. Perhaps it won't be on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. But when Pierre Bourdieu dies, he's all over the front page of Le Monde. He's an enormously significant intellectual figure. Not quite as sort of as luminous as Jean-Paul Sartre, but very near, very near. And of course, it's a French thing, you know, that the public intellectuals like Bourdieu and Sartre do become sort of major players in politics and culture in a way that they, of course, don't in this country.
Is your attraction to Bourdieu brought on partly by a sense, and I know a lot of Marxists feel this way, that Marx was too economistic, that his view of society and its features and its structures was too focused on the economy and kind of the cultural leaning of Bourdieu? And as we know, there are other thinkers in the Marxist tradition who thought about culture, but that Bourdieu's emphasis on culture is kind of refreshing and important?
No, not particularly.
All right.
I think what is important is that his claims to be innovative, or the claims of his students and disciples and followers to be innovative, overlooks parallel reformulations of Marx's writings by great Marxists, whether it be Antonio Gramsci, whether it be Lukács, whether it be the Frankfurt School of Horkheimer and Adorno or Marcuse. I mean, there's a long tradition in Western Marxism of the engagement with culture, precisely for the reasons that Bourdieu, you might say, engages in culture, that you can't ignore it. And indeed, so, I mean, Bourdieu has a very interesting commentary on Marx and on Marx's concept of class, and says that, you know, Marx didn't realize that really his greatness was not in the scientific proof that the working class would become revolutionary, but that he was persuasive as an ideologist, that that was a very appealing idea. And he didn't understand what Bourdieu calls his theory effect, that he basically his theory became a force in history itself, irrespective of the science. And then Bourdieu says the trouble is that that effect was confined to the 19th century, because in the 19th century you had not developed these cultural fields, whether it be the literary field, whether it be music, whatever, there are multiple superstructures had emerged that in fact swamped the power of Marx and Marxist ideas. So it's a very interesting idea. So that basically Marx was important so far as we didn't have the development of these superstructures, but when they develop. But as I say, Antonio Gramsci is known to be the theorist of superstructures. It's not as if somehow Marx has just stood still and regurgitated Marx, which is what you might think if you read Bourdieu. That actually Marxism, and that's of course, that we could go on for another few hours, but Marxist and Gramsci, I think, is the most interesting, because there's a clear parallel between the idea of symbolic violence and Gramsci's idea of hegemony. The two ideas thread through the corresponding theorists, Bourdieu and Gramsci. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that there is Marxism after Marx, and those Marxists have actually dealt with. So I'm using Bourdieu in some ways as a vehicle to convey to sociologists and other people who might possibly read the book or look at the book that, you know, Marxists have not been silent on the questions that Bourdieu thinks he has a monopoly on.
Michael Bourovoy, Bourovoy, sociologist based at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is Symbolic Violence, Conversations with Bourdieu, and he wrote the afterword to the new volume, How to Be an Anti-Capitalist in the 21st Century, by Eric Olin Wright, a Marxist sociologist who is based at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Michael, thanks so much for writing your book and for joining us today.
Thank you. I loved every moment of it, C.S.
And that interview first aired last October 30th. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.